So this time I talked to Matthew Continetti, founder of Free Beacon, senior fellow at the Enterprise Institute, and author of several books, including The Right, The 100-Year War for American Conservatism. I had a lot of fun with this conversation. It was also a bit of a challenge because I am liberal and Mr. Continetti is conservative, and it was a treat for me to be able to talk to someone with so much, you know, compassion and also some different views. And it was hard because I didn't want to let my bias impact any of the questions I asked, but, you know, I also still wanted to ask tough questions, or at least what I think are tough questions. I learned so much from both Continetti's book and also from this conversation. I really learned a lot about populism and the differences between, you know, conservatism, the right, all of these different terms we hear, as well as Trump's place in history. I learned about Sarah Palin. I learned about Roy Cohn. We really covered so much in this conversation, and I had a lot of fun. So here you go. Okay, so my first question is kind of a little bit broad. So what beliefs and views make you a conservative?
Well, that's a great question. There are different levels, I think, that make a person a conservative or progressive. First level, I think, is kind of your general attitude toward human nature, right? I think conservatives tend to think that human beings are flawed, that we're not perfect, and in fact, we're not perfectible. We kind of have a realistic, or that's what conservatives would say, or pessimistic view of human nature. And we kind of tend to believe in original sin, whether we are religious or not. And so at that level, at the level of anthropology, I'm a conservative. But conservative needs a modifier, right? So I am an American conservative. And even though I have that general disposition I just talked about, that view of human nature and of humanity and of human history, I'm an American conservative because I believe that we need to defend and preserve the ideas and institutions of the American founding. You know, our country is very different. Our country was explicitly founded. The French weren't founded. The French have been around for a long time, right? The Chinese have been around for even longer, right? America was created. We have documents that show our separation from the United Kingdom, right? Then we had the Articles of Confederation. That didn't work out, so we created a new government. Right, deliberately, rationally, in the Constitution. And I think an American conservative wants to defend the ideas that informed our separation from Great Britain, the ideas in the Declaration of Independence, as well as the form of government that has served us so well, in my view, for almost 250 years. And that's the form of government in the Constitution and, of course, its amendments. So I think that's my short answer as to what makes me a conservative. There's certain, you know, corollaries to those ideas, right? I think when you think about American constitutionalism, it means a few things. One is rule of law. We are ruled by a law that was agreed to two centuries ago, which we still abide by. And the rule applies to all equally, right? Or it needs, it should, right? And it should apply to all equally, regardless of their physical characteristics, right? Another idea is limited government. The Constitution limits government. It grants government very specific powers, creates spheres around each individual where that individual can make his or her own choices. So rule of law, limited government. And one consequence of limited government is that you have civil society. And I think I'm very much interested in supporting and ensuring that civil society, all the things that lie in between the individual and the government. So your family, your neighborhood, your religious affiliation, your vocation, your voluntary associations, all of those institutions flourish. And then, two, part of having a limited government in a civil society is having a relatively free market in economics, right? Limiting the degree to which the government can interfere in economic life. Finally, and I know this is a long answer, but you asked a big question. The conservative view of human nature intersects with the cons American conservative defense of the Constitution in the following way, which is that American conservatives understand that things are easily broken, right? It's easier to destroy than it is to create. And what that means is if you want to preserve something, you have to be willing to defend it by force if necessary, especially considering from a conservative perspective, a lot of people don't always have the best of intentions in mind, right? And so that leads to an idea that America needs to be militarily strong and also needs to be prepared to defend herself. And that may even mean alliances with other countries. It may mean positioning our forces overseas for long periods of time. It may mean having a standing army and spending a lot of money on national defense. But all of that, it goes to the conservative insight, in my view, that if you want something to be preserved, you need to devote a lot of resources to its maintenance and protection.
Yeah, do you think that, talking about defending institutions, do you think that Trump did any harm to those institutions?
Let's go through which ones, right?
Okay, electoral, like electoral institutions, for example.
Political institutions, right? I think this is complicated. I think while in office, Trump did not assault the Constitution directly. I think he kind of eroded some of the institutions by viewing them as extensions of his person. And we'll get back to this in a second. But Trump says, sees no distinction between himself and his office, right? He tried to run the government of the United States as basically the Trump organization writ large. And I think that eroded confidence in our institutions and eroded the independence of some of their institutions. But I don't think that damage was as severe as other people believed at the time. However, since he lost the election in 2020, he has hurt our institutions. He has hurt the cause of Republican government in the United States by making so many people believe that the election was rigged, which is a false idea, by trying to subvert the election, by trying to remain in office despite the fact that he lost, and by asking his vice president, Mike Pence, to do something that Mike Pence recognized he had no power to do, and which Mike Pence did not do. That, I think, hurt the institutions of civil liberty. And then we see, though, just to follow up, we see that even today, Trump continues to view the presidency as basically just an extension of himself. And that's why he carried all those documents with him to Mar-a-Lago. And when the government said, well, we'd like those documents back, he said, they're mine. Well, they're not. Technically, they're the government's, you know? And but yet he can't do that, right? He can't conceptualize that. That's not in his psychology. And so he's hurting the rule of law today by putting up this fight over where the documents belong, where no other president has done that.
Yeah, and then do you think that by extension he's hurt like the Conservative Party and the right in America, in terms of, now we see tons like all the people who have won, not all, but many of the people who have won their election, their midterms, Their primaries have been embracing, these ideas. And do you think that has been and that has hurt the Conservative Party and the Conservative movement?
Yes, I do. I think that it's a fair question to ask, where the conservative movement is today, where it has been for the last 6 years. I don't even think of the Republican Party as an extension of the conservative movement. I don't think of the Trump movement as really a conservative movement. I think I call it a populist nationalist movement, which incorporates some conservative ideas and which includes many conservative figures, people who had been active in the conservative movement of the last 60 years. But its aims are not the same as the conservative movement to which I belong. They can sometimes point in the same direction, but it's not always about limited government, the rule of law, equality of opportunity, open, free and open markets, national strength, through American engagement and involvement in the world. There are big differences there. And then I think that the Trump movement also flirts too much with conspiracy theory, with demagogy, and with extremist appeals. So it's something different. It replaced conservatism to a large degree. And that's where we are today.
Yeah. In terms of conspiracy theories, in your book, you talked a lot about Coughlin and his conspiracies. And do you think that the right has been drawn to conspiracies throughout history? And how have those conspiracies kind of changed?
Well, it's a great question. There are a lot of conspiracy theories that have been prevalent on the right over the last century that I cover in my book. And it's a question I often think about myself, which is there something about the right that makes it more open to conspiracy theory? I'm not so sure that's the case. There are left-wing conspiracy theories. The idea that Lee Harvey Oswald did not kill President Kennedy. It's a left-wing conspiracy theory. The idea that we never landed astronauts on the moon. I mean, is that a right-wing conspiracy theory? Is a left-wing conspiracy theory? I don't know. There was a conspiracy theory in the 1980s that the CIA had purposely put crack into the inner cities in order to fuel the crime wave at the time. That tended to be on the left. 9/11 trutherism. Right, the idea that the Bush family was in on the 9/11 attacks. There are a lot of left-wing proponents of that. There were some left-winger conspiracy theorists who thought that the 2004 election was stolen by the same company that some of the right-wing conspiracy theorists accused in 2020. So there's a funny thing about conspiracy theories. They can appear on both the left and the right. My book is about the right. So I was talking about the conspiracy theories embraced by a section of the conservatives in America or the right in America. But they can also exist on the left. And the way I think about it too is for me, the original conspiracy theory in many ways is anti-Semitism. And you can see manifestations of anti-Semitism on both the right and the left.
Yeah. And also in terms of going back a little bit to populism, also in your book you trace the populism of the right and the Conservative Party and the Republican Party. And it seems like, throughout history, populism on both sides of the aisle have it seemed to exclude someone, right? Like that's kind of built in to populism. So why do you think that is? What about populism makes it so that it needs to exclude someone?
Well, I think that's an interesting way of looking at it. The way I would put it is that populists, one of the negative features of populism, if it's not properly directed and led, is that it looks for scapegoats. So in this case, in the case of the Trump movement, the scapegoats tend to be illegal immigrants, right? I do think that sometimes in kind of left-wing populists or socialists who are adjacent to populists, you often get, and I know this is controversial, but in my view, they scapegoat the financial industry. They say the bankers and Wall Street is responsible for all of your problems. The 1% is responsible. That, to me, that's scapegoating too. I know that many people don't agree with me, but that's my perspective. So populists do tend to scapegoat when they're at their worst. What is it about that? I don't know. It has something to do with if you feel that you are being thwarted, you feel that someone is oppressing you. You have to point the finger and say, who? And that those tend in some case they can tend to be racial or ethnic minorities, they can tend to be outsiders, or they can tend to be kind of market dominant minorities, people, minorities in the population, but who have quite a bit of financial resources at their disposal. It can be a variety of people. So it's the scapegoating that worries me the most. That's why I think that Ronald Reagan was a effective populist leader, that his scapegoat, so to speak, wasn't a group. It was big government. Everything was referring to big government, which was kind of an abstraction. But he was able to say, look, big government is interfering with our lives. It's suppressing our economic potential. It's weakening America's defenses. Let's work to relimit big government. That's a different type of populist appeal that I think was much more effective than some of those that we see today.
Yeah, and how do you think, so you kind of started to touch on this a little bit, but how do you think that today's populism differs from like historical populism on the right?
Well, in some ways, it really doesn't differ all that much. One of the things that I do in my book, and I'm sure you saw, is you look at kind of earlier populists, going back to Long and Coughlin, going back to Joseph McCarthy, going back to George Wallace in the 60s and 70s, going back to Patrick Buchanan and Ross Perot in the 1990s. And then you get the kind of Sarah Palin and the Tea Party movement 15 years ago. Populism just happens. It seems to be baked into the cake of the American experiment. The question is, how far is it going to go? And who is going to lead it? And what's going to happen to that leader? What makes the current moment unique is that the populist leader became the president of the United States. That never has happened before. William Jennings Bryan, the 19th century populist, he ran for president three times, never won as a Democrat. The closest example would be one of the first major populist figures in America, which is President Andrew Jackson. We're far removed from the Jackson presidency, but in very different America, right? But I think maybe if we experienced it, we would see some similarities to what's happening now as to then. But so in the modern era, though, in the 100 years that I talk about, Donald Trump is the only one of these populist figures to actually become the president. And when that happens, things begin changing very quickly. So the presidency is an incredibly powerful office. It's an extremely unique role in history. There have only been 45 of them, I mean, individuals. 40, Biden's the 46th president. That's because we had Glo Grover Cleveland twice. Now Trump is thinking of becoming, doing a Cleveland and trying to come back to you. So when you're the president, you're not only the leader of the country who has a huge effect on our politics, on our culture, on our foreign relations. You're also the leader of your party. And so that means you're going to start having an influence on the Republican Party in Trump's case. And the Republican Party is unusual in the sense that since the 1960s, it has incorporated an ideological movement, the American conservative movement. And but having Trump as the head of that party meant that his influence would extend through the party to the movement as well. And so he has also changed the American conservative movement in the ways that you and I discussed a few minutes ago.
Yeah, so talking about, the Republican presidential primary, do you think it's going to be competitive, and what forms of, conservatism, and like what forms of the right will be on the primary stage?
Well, at this point, I do feel a lot depends on whether former President Trump decides to run or not. I do think that if he decides to run, the field will be smaller than a lot of people imagine right now. I would expect that some people would challenge Trump. Governor Larry Hogan of Maryland, I think, is likely to do that. The interesting question to me is, former Vice President Mike Pence seems pretty much on course to run for president and doesn't seem like he'd be dissuaded if his former boss ran as well. That would be an interesting matchup because it's not quite the same as a candidacy by Congresswoman Liz Cheney, right, who lost her primary to win re-election as a Republican, so she will not be in Congress next year. And a lot of people are talking about whether she might run for president either as a Republican or as an independent. Now, it's hard to see what her base of support would be, but I do think that it would be harder for the Republican National Committee to exclude Mike Pence from the debate stage than to say to Liz Cheney, no, there's no way you're getting on stage with Donald Trump. So much depends on what Trump does. Florida Governor Ron DeSantis, I think, is making a very successful play to be Trump's heir. And the puzzle there is, will he think that he could beat Trump in a primary? Will he act as though Trump is not running and just announce? How will that affect Trump's decision? Trump is under a lot of legal pressure right now. The Republican Party pays his legal bills, but that arrangement would end if he announces for president. There's just so much in politics we don't know.
Yeah. And if Ron DeSantis were to, decide to run, how do you think his campaign would differ from Trump's in terms of some of like the policies and his politics?
I don't know how big the differences will be in policy. I do think that Ron DeSantis is more of a traditional politician than Donald Trump. There won't be the crazy tweets. There won't be the outbursts that command news cycles. There will be a lot of tough talk. There will be a lot of swagger. There will be a lot of give the fight to the left. That's what the Republican base wants now. And DeSantis has done that. He is doing that as governor. There will be a lot of emphasis on results. You already see this in a lot of DeSantis's speeches. He wants to show voters that he can deliver, whether that is keeping Florida open during the pandemic, whether that is taking on Disney, whether that is making these 30 arrests or so from his election task force, arrests for voter fraud. He's going to say to the voters, I can deliver. I can fight the left and I can win. And the implicit argument there is that Trump doesn't win, that he certainly loves to fight anybody, whomever says a bad word about him. But when it comes to results, they may not have been as attractive as what DeSantis has to offer. I will say it's going to be a hard argument to make, I think, in a Republican primary because as far as most Republicans are concerned, Donald Trump is the best president of their certainly of the last 25 years, and some Republicans think he's better than Reagan. So I continue to believe that the nomination is pretty much his if he wants it.
Yeah, and kind of going back a little bit to something we mentioned earlier, can you talk a bit about, because Sarah Palin just had her recent election, so can you talk about, and I know you've written a lot about her, can you talk a bit about her and how you view her in history and what her recent election tells us?
Well, I think she's a remarkably important person in history. I think that her surprise nomination as vice president in 2008 in many ways inaugurated the era of politics that we're living in because of the visceral reactions to her, both for and against. Palin was basically taking a person. She was the governor of Alaska at the time, but her whole political profile would be was she was the hockey mom. She's kind of she's an evangelical Christian, right? She is the mother of five. Her youngest has Down syndrome. Her older son fought in Iraq, right? She's a real American, as they say, right? And she is thrust onto the national stage. No one knows who she is. And people go crazy. But not just her enemies, her supporters go crazy because they love her. And the reaction to when she came out on stage with McCain in August of 2008 was electric. And then, after all these scandals started appearing as people learned more about her in the weeks up to her speech to the Republican convention in 2008, people were like, oh my God. This is going to be a disaster. But she hit that speech out of the park. People who are too young to have watched it at the time, they need to go up on YouTube. It's quite a speech, you know. Now, Palin's flaws became manifest over the course of the general election, mainly because she just was not equipped to handle the issues presented by the financial crisis. She just didn't. No one, honestly, no one really knew how to deal with it, but Palin didn't know how to deal with it either. And yet she im quickly emerges as a crucial figure in the Tea Party movement that is a response to the financial crisis in many ways. She prefigured Donald Trump. You know, I always thought that one of the most important photos to come out of the Trump presidency was a photo of President Trump at his desk in the Oval Office. On one side, on one shoulder is Ted Nugent, the singer, and on the other side of him is Sarah Palin. I was like, there you go. That's the trinity of today's Republican Party. So now she's running for Congress, you know, and a lot of Alaskans are wondering, well, look, you know, are you really going to be serious about bringing home the bacon? Alaska depends a lot on federal help, right? Or are you going to spend more time, Sarah, kind of in the media, giving interviews, appearing on Fox? Look, she's made it to the next stage, right? Alaska's voting system is so strange. We're not actually going to know whether she won the special election, I think, for another month, which, I mean, I don't know how good of an idea that is. But she's definitely going to make it to the next stage for the ballot for the general election in November. And we'll see. For her to wind up in the House would be something else. I had this vision while watching Joe Biden's State of the Union this year. I said, wouldn't it be funny that if in a couple years Biden's giving the State of the Union and he's got Vice President Harris behind him, and then in the Speaker's chair is Sarah Palin? That would be an irony of history.
Yeah. Oh my gosh. I don't even. Yeah. So I'm editing right now, and I wanted to quickly add that we filmed this on August 23rd, and we just recently got the results of Sarah Palin's election back. And so I emailed Mr. Continetti to see if he had anything to add, and I'm going to read you word for word what he said in the email. The results tell us one, ranked choice voting hurts polarizing candidates, and two, Sarah Palin's populist credentials were not an asset in this special election. Okay, back to the interview.
And so, also talking about the midterms, has anything about them surprised you?
I'm surprised at how badly some of these GOP Senate candidates are doing in the polls. I would also say I'm a little bit surprised at the Democrats' gain in the what we call the congressional generic ballot. Just, you know, would you prefer a Republican or a Democrat to win Congress, to control Congress? And so I think the unexpected event of this cycle was the reversal of Roe v. Wade in June. And I think that has motivated a lot of Democratic voters, even in places where that won't necessarily be affected by the ruling, because they're living in states where the state government will basically preserve abortion rights. So that surprised me a little bit. However, you and I are speaking at the kind of the last 10 days of August, and it's kind of the doldrums. Not much is happening now.
Hey, I live in New York. We have our election.
Yeah, you have your primary day today. I know. I was just talking about that with some friends.
Yeah.
So it's exciting. But my point being, the real election, the general election, doesn't really start until Labor Day. And I still expect the Republicans to do very well.
Yeah. And so then in terms of, yeah, so what do you think are like the strengths and weaknesses of today's right?
Well, the main strength of today's right is that it is the left, put it that way. I think the right does best when Americans get sick of progressive overreach or mismanagement, and then they turn to the right. American voters are not ideological. They don't even think about politics all that much, certainly not as much as you or I do. And they want the same things that anybody wants. They want a job. They want good schools. They want safe neighborhoods, you know, and they want to be proud of their community and their country, right? So if all of a sudden they are paying more for gas and for groceries, if their kids are coming home from the school talking about white privilege and heteronormativity, right? If crime is on the increase, and if America had this awful withdrawal from Afghanistan that ended in a debacle and is involved in this war in Ukraine that is just kind of going on with no real resolution, they're going to say, well, Biden's not delivering. Democrats aren't delivering. We'll go to the alternative. However, that doesn't mean that they're signing up for the full MAGA agenda, right? And so we kind of live live in kind of this metronome. It just swings back and forth. It's the same thing with the Trump years. In that case, the economy was doing well. People liked the economy. Schools, there's some craziness, but nowhere near what had been revealed by the pandemic and everything like that. Crime was starting to rise in some places, but for the most part, fine. But then when it gets to that pride in your community and your country, I think a lot of people are just like, I can't take Trump anymore. He just makes us look silly, you know? And he's just saying these things, and everyone is running around like their hair is on fire. And so we need an alternative. And, you know, let's get that guy who spends most of his time in his basement, right? Put him up there. Fine. Just get Trump out, right? And that's, I think, what led to Trump losing in 2020. But the problem was that Biden thought people were voting for him and for his big, big agenda. They weren't. They were just voting to get Trump out. And so now I think the Democrats will pay for that in the fall.
Yeah. And so in terms of, you mentioned briefly Biden's withdrawal from Afghanistan, in terms of like interventionist foreign policy and non-interventionist foreign policy, you know, how do you view Biden's withdrawal from Afghanistan? And do you think it changed foreign policy that way at all?
Well, I am a vocal opponent of his withdrawal from Afghanistan. I think it was a humiliation. I think it was a disaster. I think it was a more important a tragedy. And there are millions and millions of Afghans who now live with no freedom. The Taliban are just reimposing their religious rule, which kept that country in a state of medievalism before the American intervention. We now know that Al-Qaeda is in Afghanistan. Of course, we were able to kill Zawahiri, one of the leaders of Al-Qaeda, one of the founders of Al-Qaeda, but he was in Afghanistan. We had been told by our government, oh no, don't worry about Al-Qaeda. They're not there anymore. Well, they're there. So the humanitarian disaster, the harm done to our security, the harm done to our reputation. We have this network of alliances that span the world, from the East Asia to Europe. And those alliances depend on credibility, the idea that our partners have confidence that we will be good on our pledges, right? That was dealt a heavy blow by Afghanistan. And I will say the way in which we have supported NATO vis-a-vis the Ukraine war may have recovered some of that, but I do think there was great harm done. I think your question is right, which is that since the war in Iraq, mainly, the American public has turned against intervention in foreign policy, or at least that's what America's political class thinks. And so we've had a very almost passive-aggressive foreign policy now since 2009, even a little bit earlier, since the surge in Iraq, which was 2007. So it's 15 years. And maybe we're getting to get some of our confidence back by helping the Ukrainians preserve their independence. But I worry that if the outcome in Ukraine is not one where we can say that American support had positive benefits, America's role in the world will take another blow. And that to me is very worrisome, because it's not just like America can say, well, we just don't care about what happens overseas. One, the enemies will come and find us. Two, because of technology now, missile technology, space technology, satellite technology, cyber technology, the border distance doesn't really matter, right? And three, it's not as though if America says, well, we're not going to help provide security, things will all work out. Other countries will move in. And that would be, in my view, a much less free world and a much less prosperous world, and a much less humane world if we allow countries like Russia and China to dictate the rules for everyone else.
Yeah, and I think what's interesting about that too is from my perspective, I live in New York, I've been immersed in kind of like liberal culture and democratic culture for a while. And I feel like we've kind of also taken the view that like Trump did a lot of damage to our foreign relations as well, in terms of, damaging our ability to maintain our deals, like in terms of the Paris Climate Accord. We went into that and then we like stepped out with Trump. So how do you think this is like a continuation of that, and that we've been kind of like degrading our view overseas for a while?
Well, I would say that Trump leaving the Climate Accord had historical precedent. George W. Bush left the Kyoto Protocol in 2001. He also left the Anti-Ballistic Missile Treaty, the ABM Treaty. So there is historical precedent of presidents coming in and exiting treaties that they do not believe serve the national interest. Do you think that for Trump, he eroded our standing in the world in the sense that many of our partners just didn't know what to make of him, in particular our NATO partners? We've been part of the NATO alliance since the late 1940s. kind of originated it. It depends on Article 5, the mutual defense clause. Trump is a critic of that. Trump was a critic of NATO. Many of our allies there were worried that he would try to leave NATO. What would that mean? Now, what it meant in the short term was that Trump got his way. Many of them boosted their military budgets. Though the truth is, the best person to get Europe to boost their military budget was Vladimir Putin by invading Ukraine. There is some question. Trump eroded our place in the world, I think, through his always having an asterisk on that question of American credibility. There are other parts of Trump's foreign policy which I personally supported and agreed with, but I would point to that as being a place where I found that he was wrong. I also, of course, we have to mention that he started this process of withdrawing from Afghanistan. He was the one who made this deal with the Taliban. Biden continued it, but Trump started it. And look, I think that we could have at least preserved an oasis of freedom in Afghanistan, even if it was only around Kabul. We could have let the other outlying territories just kind of leave them alone. But Kabul was a huge city. It was becoming westernized. And now that's all gone. And now the Taliban have a base, and Al-Qaeda has a potential refuge. And our security is damaged.
Yeah. So we've been talking a lot about foreign policy. I want to just go back to one of the things from your book that I found really interesting. You know, the prevalence of this saying America first. I just think it's interesting that this saying kind of pops up in different times in history. And so what do you think unites the times that it's popped up, and what do you think makes them different?
Well, you know, what unites the figures who use this phrase is a sense that America should not be engaged overseas. America should not defend other countries. America should be concerned with itself, America first. It tends to have a closed view of the world, right? And it carries over not just to foreign policy and intervention, but also to immigration, right? We should close ourselves off to immigration and to international economic policy. So we should close ourselves off to foreign imports, right? You can look at the figures who use that phrase, America first, whether it's in the 1940s, the 1990s, or today. And on all three of those questions, they would take the closed position. What's interesting is the phrase originates, of course, with the America First Committee, which opposed American entry into World War II. And the main spokesman of the America First Committee was Charles Lindbergh. Right? America First Committee closed the day after Pearl Harbor, and that was it. The phrase was resurrected by Pat Buchanan when he began his presidential campaigns in the 1990s. And Buchanan knew what he was doing. He knew where that phrase came from, and he was purposely using it. He wanted the right to begin to look more like the right before World War II than the Cold War right of the intervening decades. When Trump uses it, beginning in 2016, it's not clear to me that he knew exactly where it came from, though I don't know. He does watch a lot of World War II documentaries. I mean, he is interested in that period. So he may have known too. He just never said, right? But the ideas are the same, regardless of whether you acknowledge the source.
Right. Yeah, that's interesting. That's a good question. I wonder if he knew. Yeah, we should ask him. another thing from your book, and also kind of like anecdotally, I recently read Angels in America. And so one of the things in your book that kind of like caught my interest was Roy Cohn. And I was surprised at his appearance in your book. So can you talk a little bit about his impact on the right?
Well, I think it was indirect, but he was an aide to Senator Joseph McCarthy. He was one of McCarthy's chief kind of inquisitors, McCarthy running his counter-subversion campaigns in the Senate, his investigations into communist sympathizers in the executive branch of government. Cohn was part of that. Cohn then later reappears because he's Donald Trump's attorney. And Trump loved Roy Cohn. And Cohn was also a closeted gay man. And so that's how he figures into Angels in America, which you said you just read. He was a very aggressive figure, whether it was in his investigations or whether it was in his legal work. He was very combative. He was always turning it up to the max. And that's something that both McCarthy and Trump admired.
Yeah. And also another question I had was, how do you think, like, kind of comparing and contrasting McCarthyism and Trumpism? Because there seems like there's a lot of similarities and also like some differences.
Right. Well, McCarthyism focused on the internal enemy, communists in the government. McCarthy was a senator going after the executive branch. So there was a fight between the two branches of government. That's really what ended McCarthy, was when he started going after figures in the military, President Eisenhower, who belonged to the same party as McCarthy, they were both Republicans, began very surreptitiously and cleverly undermining him to the point where eventually in 1954, he was censured by the Senate. Trump, you know, it's more focused on the outsider. It's more focused on the illegal immigrant. It's more focused on China, you know, how they're taking our jobs. Though he's shifted now, he understood the woke, the anti-woke stuff, that is more kind of an internal enemy, right? We got to prevent the woke from taking over. So Trump is shifting, you know, he's a politician. He's going to try to figure out what's going to attract the majority of his voters. So I think the similarities with McCarthyism and Trumpism are, of course, in the style. There's an outlandishness to it, the combativeness to it, the conspiratorial aspects to it. And that, of course, connects both major political figures.
Yeah. And then another thing, you know, from your book, it was also like talking about the Cold War and why it was so important for American politics and like especially on the right. So what do you think the Cold War changed and why was it able to change the party so drastically?
Well, the reason the Cold War changed the American right was communism. Communism has always been enemy number one of the American right for a variety of reasons. It's atheistic, and so religious people don't like it. It is collectivist, so if you're free market, you don't like it because it means economic control, no individual rights. It is bureaucratic, so your freedom is threatened. And then also it's a national security threat, because communism under Joseph Stalin, especially after World War II, wanted a world revolution, wanted to expand. So that forced the right to really reevaluate its traditional stances toward the world. It made the right more open to foreign intervention, made the right more open to alliances like NATO, to the forward deployment of our forces in Europe and Asia, to fighting in places like Korea and Vietnam, because we were fighting communism. Made the right more open to spending a lot of on the military. You know, a lot of free market types don't like to spend on the military. They think it's just big government, but because of communism, they said, all right, we need to make a compromise here. Free trade. Conservatives became less protectionist because we thought that free trade would help build up our allies in the fight against communism. And so that's really the main ways in which Cold War conservatism was different from the old right, pre-World War II conservatism, and the MAGA movement of today.
Yeah, I guess my question is also, you know, like, why did the Cold War accomplish this where, like, World War II didn't, right? Like why was it that it was the Cold War that was able to do this when, you know, there was socialism in World War II that we were fighting and all that kind of stuff?
Well, I think the main difference was, well, a couple of things. One was, I think World War II reminded people, or a lot of people learned from World War II, that we can't just pretend America is protected by the two oceans. So the case here would be Michigan Senator Arthur Vandenberg, who was against American involvement in World War II, but coming out of the war recognized that no, America needs to be involved overseas, or else the threat will come too late. Pearl Harbor changed a lot of minds, in other words, right? And then the second thing was, communism had a, there was that internal part too, so that the right was very worried about, at least coming out of the war, communist subversion within the United States. And so they were looking internally. That's how McCarthy kind of came to power. But then they could connect that back to a foreign power as well. And so, why don't we actually look at the source of the problem? The source of the problem is the Soviet Union. And that means we need to take a more confident and aggressive stance in foreign policy. We need to seek to roll back the Soviet Union, to defeat the Soviet Union, not just to contain it, which is what the other politicians in the Democratic and Republican parties wanted to do.
Okay, so as we're getting closer to, you know, time, I have a couple of, I think they're fun questions.
Okay.
So, well, this one is, the first one is, what is the shape of the political spectrum and why?
The shape of the political spectrum.
Yeah.
Well, you know, I think it changes over time. The traditional left-right, of course. Ronald Reagan used to say there's no left or right, there's only up or down. Up toward the maximum of individual liberty consistent with law and order, or down to the ash heap of totalitarianism. Today, I think it's less about the size of government than it is about who counts, you know, and then what the freedom of that government to act. So it's a little bit different. So I guess my main answer would be that this political spectrum can change over time. And that's maybe why some people have been confused by the great ruptures in our politics in recent years.
Yeah. And then the other question I had is, if you had to, and you can decide not to answer this, if you had to pick a favorite era of American conservatism and like the era you'd most want to emulate, what would you choose?
Well, I think the era that has the most lessons for us today would be the era of the 1970s, a period of kind of stagflation at home and humiliation abroad, a sense of American malaise and decline. And the conservatives at that time were offering not only theories about what had gone wrong, but actual concrete proposals for how to fix it. And I think that's the job of American conservatives today, not only to complain about what's happening, not only to say, well, this is why things are happening, but to say, here's what we do about it. And here's how we can actually affect policy in ways that will improve people's lives.
Yeah. What do you think are some of those policy ideas from that era that we could maybe carry over?
Well, the most obvious one would be on criminal justice policy. The idea of broken windows which came out of the thinking of a neoconservative named James Q. Wilson, which is that, you know, little things count and you have to enforce little quality of life things before you get to the big stuff. And James Q. Wilson was also an advocate of community policing as well, cops on the beat, to help instill a sense of order. I think that's very important today. I think on the level of economic policy, I think we could learn from Milton Friedman, who at the time was taught that inflation is above all a monetary phenomenon. And I think that would encourage us to look at what the Federal Reserve is doing to fight inflation. It would also mean that we need to increase the supply, the capacity in our economy, as the supply siders of the 1970s advocated. And that would mean less regulation. That would mean actually, you know, making good on the deal that Joe Manchin supposedly made with Pelosi and Schumer, that there is going to be some permitting reforms so we can get these projects going faster. I'm skeptical that will happen, but that's something that I think conservatives would do. Increasing the supply of housing, I think, was very important because that would bring it down. Also, not like overlaying it with all these regulations regarding affordable housing. I think we just need to allow people the space to build. So I think there are several ways in which the politics and ideas of the 1970s can inform our own time, which resembles them in many ways.
Yeah, that's amazing. Thank you so much for your time. This has been so informative. I think that's all the questions I have. Do you have anything you'd like to add or say?
Not at all. Thank you very much. And good luck with your podcast.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate it. All right.